You're listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards. On today's programme, we're rounding up some of July's book releases, and joining me in the studio is the author and critic, Mark Mason. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Good to have you with us. Later in the programme, we'll be discussing new releases by the journalist Ian Maitland and food writer Elizabeth Luard. But our first book today is Shrunk and Other Stories by Oliver Black, a professor of philosophy and law. It's a series of essays and stories based on his life, but with a little artistic license. Mark, before we critique it, tell us a bit about some of the tales in this book. What is the sort of the thing that's binding this all together?
I think it's binding it all together is that it's his everyday life. It's one of those books of funny little. He's been called the British David Sedaris,
High praise.
Yes,
high praise
which
indeed.
Is very good. And he's very good. He's a city lawyer and also a professor of philosophy, Oliver Black. And I don't know if it's nominative determinism, but the humour is very black. It's sort of, the sort of tale is things like he making his own, making a coffin for his mother. They've got some quotes for his mother's funeral. And this happened to me last year with my partner's father. Just the astonishing cost of a funeral and what the rubbish service that you get. So he thinks, I'm not going to do it. So they got a carpenter to make the coffin. And that went very well. And then they did it for some other relatives after they'd done his mother. And it's so black. He actually got to the stage of, at the crematorium, the guy who runs the crematorium said, do you want to come and see the coffin go into the furnace? And he went, yeah, okay. And this is with his own mother. And so there's a little window that you can see in through the door. So he watches that happen. And then when they start making coffins for other people, they got one made, I think it was for his partner's mother, this one, that they needed somewhere to store it before they put the mother in it. And I think she was on her way out, and they got the coffin made in good
right.
time.
And sorry, so they put it. Chuckle. It's they really
put,
funny,
well, no, it? It's brilliant. They put it under the table, and I've got the quote, the exact quote here. It was, they didn't mention it. It's under the dining table. No one could see it. They had some people around for dinner. They didn't mention it until one of them banged her toe on it, and so an explanation was necessary. After that, the conversation flagged.
No kidding. Yeah.
And the arguments he gets into with taxi drivers and going for therapy, and because he's a deeply, deeply unhappy bloke, but manages to extract the humour from it. It's a really good book.
So there's obviously a real flair for the macabre, definitely in that coffin story. But what about the self-reflective elements? Because he describes himself as London's leading hypochondriac, and as you mentioned there's lots of therapy and alternative remedies that are sought. And is it a winning personality that comes to the fore here?
Absolutely. In that he never talks about, this is a book all about himself, but he does that clever thing of pulling it off without talking about himself too much. He talks about going for his own therapy, but then he gives up on therapy. That whole chapter is about how the therapist that he's been through, and he's decided it's not for him. Because in one of them, he could hear the therapist's receptionist through the very flimsy door. So in the middle of his therapy session, he can hear this receptionist going, I said to Steve, ... New curtains, ... Las Vegas this year, ... It was her bunions. So, and so he's not one of those annoying people who tries to turn everything into a joke for its own sake. He's not one of those, a one-liner about that. He's very often using the humour to get to a point about the bleakness of life or whatever it is. But he does it without talking about himself too much.
I wonder also, Oliver Black, someone who has written, in sort of autobiographical terms, but he's also written fiction, a lot of it kind of comedic. Do you think that in a way it's easier for writers who kind of get fiction to write about themselves in a more compelling way?
That's a very interesting thought. It's never occurred to me, but I think it could be. He's certainly got a novelist's touch in terms of looking for the comic detail. And I used to write fiction, I now write non-fiction, so I know from experience that the joy of writing non-fiction is that when something happens, like there's a place that he visits regularly, and one of the residents nearby has got two cars with private number plates, one of which is 2B and the other is not 2B. And if you put that in a novel, no one would believe it. Yeah. Or it would just seem like a useless joke, a not very funny joke. But the fact that it's really happened, is that's the joy of nonfiction, is that the world is far stranger than you can ever create in fiction. And reading a book like this opens you up to the joy of that.
That's Shrunk and Other Stories by Oliver Black, which is out now, published by Prospero. Let's move on. In a manner of speaking, Mark, but there are some certain sort of strains that run through the next volume that we're going to discuss. It's a book by Ian Maitland called Dear Michael, Love, Dad, which follows a series of correspondence between Maitland and his son, Michael, when he leaves home for university, later becomes hospitalised due to depression, anorexia. Challenging backdrop. how's the relationship here depicted, Mark? Is it the sort of, are there some classic tropes of the father and son relationship?
There could have been. It was really disappointing. I was really looking forward to reading this because I'm a father now, and I'm always fascinated by, you know, my own relationship with my father and with my son. So it's a really rich subject. And the problem is he does exactly the opposite of Oliver Black in that he does talk about himself all the time in not a very entertaining way. The book, Ian's the father, Michael is the son. And I assumed that it was going to be letters between the two of them. Normally with a correspondence, you get both sides of the story. This is all Ian. There's a tiny little bit that his son has written specially for the book at the end. His son has written a short poem at the end and has got a few bits of input at the end, but you know, short few paragraphs. Mm. Virtually all of the book is just the letters that Ian wrote to his son. And the story is, as you say, he goes away, leaves home and becomes anorexic. And it gradually dawns on them. And one of the themes is how long it takes for it to dawn on his family, because they still see him fairly regularly. So when someone's getting thinner and thinner and you see them all the time, it's not as though they've gone away for 6 months and come back half the way before. So it takes them a long time for it to dawn on them. And the constant theme is Ian saying, I'm not a very good father. I don't do the hugging stuff. That's the phrase he always comes back to. He's not very touchy-feely because he had a bad relationship with his own father, he says. So again, that could have been interesting if it was tackled in the right way. Mm. But he's very bad at analysing his feelings. That's one of the problems. In as many words, he says several times, I'm no good at analysing emotions. In that case, why write a book about
which
it?
Which is clearly such a sort of an emotional and emotive study. It seems an odd choice.
Yeah. And then the crucial, in as much as he can look at what happened and analyse it, he says, I think the problem was they've got two other children and it's one of those big families where everyone's always joshing and joking and taking the mickey and there's lots going on and physically, you know, just people are in and out of the house all the time, and they just didn't notice that maybe Michael had some problems that then developed into the anorexia. And he says, so, you know, I think that's in his letters, he's saying to his son, I think that's what happened. I feel guilty if that's what happened and that we didn't pay you enough attention. But then he just talks about himself all the time. A lot of the book is about the sister's boyfriends and things that are happening, supposedly comic things, the sort of stuff that Oliver Black would have written a brilliant book about, are just quite tedious. Other people's domestic lives can be quite tedious. And it was a real irony. It dawned on me halfway through the book, he's doing exactly the thing in the book that he thinks he got wrong in life with Michael, in that going on about himself all the time or talking about other members of the family, you don't get to hear from Michael. And it's one of those books that teaches you how to do it by showing you how not to do it. It makes you realise how good the other ones are.
So even if my initial question about, you know, what does it tell us about the nature of a relationship between father and son is wrong, perhaps the correct question would have been, what does it tell us about what it is to be a parent? But maybe there's almost a lack of insight unfortunately.
There is. I think he's like one of those, I don't know what you compare it to. I mean, I feel very guilty saying this about the book because it's obviously a massively painful experience that the family have been through. But if you are going to turn this sort of story into a book, you've got to do it properly, because otherwise you just end up repeating. He spends 250, whatever it is, pages repeating the problem that happened in real life, just going on about himself. He does sound like one of those people at a party who would try and make a joke of everything and be tedious. And on the page, that really starts to get on your nerves after a while.
Well, Dear Michael, Love, Dad by Ian Maitland is out on the 28th of July, published by Hodder and Stoughton. But perhaps if you want some real insight into the nature of contemporary relationships, and if you want it to be Blackley comic, we're directing people in the direction of Oliver Black.
Take the black lane, yes.
Let's change our tack entirely, Mark, and talk food before the show is out. Our last book's a memoir by Elizabeth Luard called Squirrel Pie and Other Stories. It takes us on an adventure around the world to tell the tales of the people, cultures and ingredients that Luard's come across in her time as a food writer. And Mark, I imagine a number of our listeners probably familiar with Elizabeth Luard and her writings. What sort of stories do we get here? Are we served up, for want of a better phrase? Kind of what we would expect.
Yeah, it's great. It's great stuff. I've not read any of her other books, but this is sort of the human tale from her travels around the world. And there's lots of food in there as well, and there are recipes in there as well. But it's really how what we eat tells us about about who we are. For instance, the thing about the Spanish Inquisition, which in the 15th century, most of Spain and Portugal was a Muslim territory, and then the Spanish Inquisition you know, banned being Muslim, basically, for want of a better phrase. And the way they used to go around, and when they questioned people, nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition, they'd go around, and a lot of the questions were about food and what are you eating. And if a family said they were eating pork, they would know they were Christian because the Muslims wouldn't eat pork. But if they said they weren't, if the pork wasn't included, there was a suspicion that the family might be practicing Muslims. And it's a real insight into how the most important thing in our life, food, without it we'd die, can tell us a lot about what we are.
But what's interesting about that is it's asking some big questions. As you said, food is, you know, of profound importance to everybody. But there's presumably a lightness of touch, and there's some entertainment. People know Elizabeth Lugard for her sort of, she's a very evocative writer. She can be very entertaining. There's a turn of phrase and lots of colour as well. There's light and shade in this.
I guess. And how the world's changing as well. And how, you think, because food's constantly changing and the way we consume it is changing. One of the things she spots in India, she's told in India, that a lot of the Westerners going to India take their tea without sugar, and the Indians have started copying them, and it's massively improved dental health in India. That all the dentists that Indians used to have they used to have massive amounts of sugar, very bad for their teeth. So there are lots of dentists, and these dentists now haven't got anything to do because all the teeth are so good. So they do teeth whitening, and as she said, even the poorest want to look like Bollywood stars. So you can never pin a subject like this down and say, right, that's it. There's always going to be something new to write about. But then also going back with the recipes from centuries ago, one of her recipes is called boubou tea. I don't know if I've pronounced that correctly. I think that's a French recipe. Certainly it's a French-sounding name. Yeah, it's French. It's a snail broth. And the name comes from, you cut the snails in their shells, and it's the sound of the shells banging against each other as it bubbles away. Boubou tea. And, recipe. And also had the same food or drink can give lots of differences around the world. In Arles, in France, there is a coffee shop which wasn't allowed, it's not allowed to have a coffee roaster in the shop because the neighbours objected to the smell. And as she says in the book, who in their right mind is going to object to the smell of freshly roasted coffee, yeah, wafting down the street? But then in Ethiopia, workmen like coffee so much that they add it to their tea.
Tea with coffee. Fascinating. So what is this book? I mean, is it part memoir, part... It's almost encyclopedic. I don't know. Is it a genre-defying work?
It's I don't know what genre you would... I'd say food travel memoir, in that it's lots of her stories. I think she's gone to places specifically for the book, but she's also back referencing, experiences from decades ago. But she gets, again, coming back to this thing about writing about yourself, there's just enough of an insight into her family life. A massively touching thing is that she had a daughter who died of AIDS. Lawad's in her 70s now, and she had a daughter who died in her 20s, about 20 years ago. And there's a beautiful bit where, again, in Arles, she goes to a chocolate shop, and it reminds her of morning cakes. I'd never heard of morning cakes, as in O-U-R, as in little bits of cake and sweet things that would be given to mourners at a funeral to cheer them up, as a nice little let's be happy moment. And she's thinking of that she's thinking of her daughter. She used to go to Arles with her daughter as the woman's wrapping up the chocolates with a ribbon in the shop. And because the woman says, is it a gift? Is it for a gift for somebody? Would you like me to wrap it? Would you like a ribbon? And she says, yes, my daughter would like a ribbon. She imagines that she's buying him for her dead daughter. It's a really, really just the right amount of human insight and the stories about other people. It's a fantastic book.
And she goes further than just committing pen to paper. She's done, as I understand it, some of the sketches. Is that right as well?
Yeah.
How does it look as well?
It looks beautiful. At the end of every chapter, there are some recipes that relate to what she's been talking about in the chapter. And then there are sketches. And she talks a lot about that, or she writes a lot about that in the book. You feel it's one of those books you feel as though she's talking to you. It's that well written. She goes around with a little sketch pad, and instead of taking photos, she likes sketching, and they're brilliant. A little sketch of a street market in Spain or whatever it is. It's a beautiful book to look at. I haven't actually had to go at any of the recipes yet, so I shall be having. I was reading this while I was trying to lose a bit of weight. It was one of those really.
I don't recommend squirrel pie. No, if that's what you're thinking about.
It was one of those books that's really hard to read. You're trying to think, I'm not going to have anything to eat for a few hours now. out, and then you have to read about this gorgeous food.
Wonderful stuff. Well, it's Squirrel Pie and Other Stories: Adventures in Food from Around the World by Elizabeth Leward. It's out today, published by Bloomsbury, and that brings us to the end of today's programme. Mark Mason, my guest today, thanks very much for being with us. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards. Our producer was Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time tomorrow when we'll be discussing this week's film releases with Tara Judah. But for now, thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.